Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. A sinkhole opened in the parking lot of the Tanger Outlet Shopping Center in Lancaster County last week that covered almost 20 parking spaces. Another sinkhole on the Cumberland Parkway in Cumberland County was more than 20 feet deep. Palmyra in Lebanon County had two more sinkholes and is well known for sinkholes along Route 422. The ground opened for these sinkholes when the area was getting hammered with more than 10 inches of rain, some places up to 15 inches of rain. Is that why there were so many, or is something else going on underground? The science of sinkholes, our discussion today with Bill Kochanov, who is the senior geologic scientist with the Bureau of Topographic and Geological Survey, Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. He also authored a 2015 report, Sinkholes in Pennsylvania. Mr. Kochanov, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, this is one of those topics that you look at a sinkhole and say, well, what's going on here? If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, Bill, I look back through my records and saw that you were on the program just over a year ago. And at that time, you were on right after a few more sinkholes had opened in Palmyra. But now, here in the last 2 weeks, just as I listed, those are just a few. There were some Route 30 in Lancaster County, Route 283 in Lancaster County, other areas of the region as well. Start with the basics. What is a sinkhole?
Well, sinks are part of a natural process occurring where there is limestone bedrock. Over very, 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 very long periods of time, these rocks have a tendency to dissolve over time, especially along the cracks that are in the rocks. These help to form what I like to call a sort of a natural plumbing network, where the water enters, kind of serve as the drains, and the cracks in the rocks are sort of the pipes. And over time, the plumbing system gets clogged up with soil. Now, water, whether it comes in the form of rain or from disrupted utility lines, any type of things like that, a water source, that they may have a function sort of as the Drano and kind of can flush the soil out of our plumbing system and leave holes behind as a result. And so we can think of sinks as a natural process, but it's a water-driven process. So it helps to form the actual openings under the ground, and as a secondary effect, can actually help to create the sinkholes by, again, flushing materials down into these openings that have developed over long periods of time.
I want to talk about that geology, the limestone, in just a moment, but I think everyone, maybe everyone is not the right way to put it, maybe you didn't, but a lot of people assumed that the amount of rain we got over the past 2 weeks, that was the reason for these sinkholes opening. Was it?
Well, again, think of the sinkholes as a plumbing issue in a natural sense. So whether you have a lot of rain falling at one time, well, it sort of upsets the balance of the water that's within, you know, the... Okay, let's back up just a bit here.
Okay.
The water that falls as rain or precipitation will try to find its way down to the water table. Okay, that's the part where the water source starts to collect once it infiltrates into the ground. And so, you know, once we start getting water that exceeds the natural amounts, it can start, it'll basically make the water table rise or drop. Now, this rise and drop can affect the plumbing in, we can use a bathtub as an analogy. We have a clog in the bathtub drain. We could look at it and say, oh, well, geez, the water's draining real slowly. We can use a proper declogging agent. You notice, okay, everything's flowing real nice now. So it's the same sort of thing. So once the water starts to infiltrate through the ground, it kind of starts to back up. And in some cases, you can get flooding in sinkhole areas simply because the drains are backing up. Or if it's just if the infiltration rates are okay, then you may just get a flushing event. In that case, the sinkhole opens up. But where it does flood, or where we do get lots of water, sometimes the actual sinks don't happen right away. They may start to occur when the actual water table begins to drop. And that kind of removes the support from the water table that's holding up the land surface. And as it drops, it can loosen up that soil where the drain was and cause a hole to open up. Excessive amounts of water. We can go into look at, say, for example, we have a parking lot. All the water is being running off the parking lot. It's looking for a place to go. So as a design factor, we will put in stormwater drains, or we'll direct it into a certain area. Now, that area may not, what was normally would have infiltrated into the ground, now it's being collected and sent over to a specific area, an area that never really receives that much volume of water at any one particular time in a undeveloped type of perspective. So, you know, by changing the water routes, covering them up or redirecting them can sometimes impact the location and the degree at which sinkholes can occur.
Is that why, and I'm assuming here, because we hear about them most often, is that why more sinkholes develop on roads or a hard surface like a parking lot?
Yeah, you could think of the what we call the karst landscape, where the sinkholes occur. That it took a very, very long time for that to develop, all right, thousands to millions of years. And, you know, and as we've come along and built on top of this surface, we've sometimes do not consider places where the water naturally would have went. Sure, we can see where water, surface water goes from spot to spot, but oftentimes we don't get a clear picture as to where the groundwater is moving as it goes from area to area. So once we cover up the land surface, we can sometimes manage where surface water can go. But oftentimes we don't, it's difficult to manage groundwater and how it goes from one spot to another spot. So it's sort of it's become sort of a necessary thing in land use to, in stormwater management issues, to find out where the water is going and to figure out ways to, you know, find places to send it, basically.
Under normal circumstances, that planning, that, you know, finding places for that groundwater to go works. And no one, it's underground, no one knows anything different. But when there's 13 inches of rain or more coming within, like, say, a 10-day period, that's an unusual event.
Correct. You know, you can design a facility to accept a certain amount of rain over a given period of time. A couple inch rainfall is a typical design. You know, you design a basin to hold that much amount of water. But when you do get that excessive amount of rains, you know, all bets are off. Because normally facilities aren't designed to handle excessive amounts. I mean, when you get 10 plus inches of rain, no one really effectively designs for those large, atypical type of rainfalls. And so they can sometimes overwhelm the stormwater facility that's in place that was designed for a particular place and can create different problems, you know, or exacerbate sinkhole development.
But I heard, you know, in some of the reports about the Tanger in particular. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people out there taking photographs. You know, it became kind of a spectator event because it's something you don't see very often. And by the way, just to let kind of a shout out to Tanger Outlets, the shopping center is still open. They did not close. I mean, it's a big parking lot there and maybe up to 20 parking spaces and it's fenced in, but they are still open. But a lot of people went out there to take a look because it is so unusual. And I understand that there was a tank underneath that. But again, one of the reports that I heard, more than one of the reports I heard, was that it was being investigated as to whether the rain caused this or not. And I thought to myself, okay, well, that can't be a coincidence that we got 13 inches of rain and the sinkhole, this large sinkhole, opens up. So what would be investigated? I mean, can it logically be assumed that the rain was part of this or behind it?
Well, when we have sinkhole formation, one, you need a place for material to go to. There has to be an opening somewhere underground for that surface material to get for it, somewhere for it to go. And then you need some sort of medium to move it, and that's typically water. So, you know, then we go to the three-door model here. You know, what caused the actual hole? Well, you could be in a limestone area, and you could check that box off. Is there underground mining in that area? Well, no, not in this particular case. And then there's door number three, where, you know, we look at the impact of what I call constructional relics, things that are left buried in the ground, or infrastructure items that, you know, may have failed or, you know, have been in the ground, but, you know, we've built beyond that.
Is that a big problem, Pennsylvania?
Oh, yeah. A lot of the calls I get are of that variety, where they're not even in a limestone area, but they'll have features that look like sinkholes. And with some discussion with the clients, they'll actually start saying, oh, yeah, I remember there was a septic tank out in the backyard. It was disconnected. It was never taken out. But over time, it decomposes, rots away, or just fails. And the result is a hole in the ground. Even trees, some people will cut the tree off, but they leave the roots in the ground. And over time, they rot away. And again, leaving openings underground, and over, you know, at some event, there'll be a hole there all of a sudden, you know, and say, oh, my, look, it's a sinkhole. Well, not really, you know, it's sort of so you have to kind of play detective if you're a homeowner. What was on the property before you became owner of it, you know? Is that all have been disclosed to you to say, oh, yeah, well, that's, you know, that there was this and that out in the backyard there. There was a small shed out there in the back. The foundation's still in the ground, those sorts of things. So there's plenty of mysteries out there that can account and look like sinkholes. But once you start looking and sorting out the variables, and, you know, we find out that, well, you know, there's other explanations for it.
So why is it important then? You named three possibilities being investigated. Why is it important to determine?
Well, again, it's sort of like narrowing down the things. If you're not in a limestone area, then you're right away moving to either there's a subsurface mine, or there's some sort of relic structure underground there that may be causing that particular problem. And so, you know, and it kind of helps to sort out what an individual homeowner would have to do in order to fix it. You know, if it's in the limestone area, and, oh, geez, you know, I looked down there and it went 20 foot deep, but there seemed to be a tunnel and it seemed to go deeper than that. Well, you know, that's a different story, and you may have to go through a different method of remediation to fix or to plug that hole up, as if it was, oh, geez, it's just a 3 foot depression in the backyard. Oh, I peeled back the grass, and, oh, geez, you know, there was some rotted trash dump that was buried there a long time ago. So, and then, well, we'll just put some clean fill in it, and that'll be the end of it, you know. So by going and looking at the different possibilities, it helps to determine a method of repair.
And we're going to talk about those repairs in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about sinkholes during this portion of the program. As you're well aware, or probably well aware, we've had a number of them open up in central Pennsylvania over the past 3 weeks, and a lot of it could be due to the heavy amounts of rain we got. Some areas up to 15 inches of rain in central Pennsylvania. Of course, there were some sinkholes a little bit larger than what we normally see here in central PA that got a lot of attention. Our guest today is Bill Kochanoff, I want to make sure I pronounce your name correctly, Bill. Bill Kochanoff, who is the senior geologic scientist at the Bureau of Topographic and Geological Survey, Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. If you have a question or a comment talking about the science of sinkholes, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On WITF's Twitter page, or on, I should say on Smart Talk's Twitter page, you can send a tweet to SmartTalk at WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Give us a call. So, Bill, you were just talking about ways to repair sinkholes. And I know that's a big question that many people have. But before we even get there, I think one of the other big questions that a lot of people may have is, if one opens up, does that mean that there's more potential for a sinkhole in that area?
Well, it's one of these, it depends, you know. So
that's why we have you here, Bill.
Because a sinkhole opens up in one area doesn't mean that, one's going to open up throughout that area, you know. But usually in the limestone areas where there's limestone bedrock, that is fairly common to get sometimes clusters of sinks. You know,
Palmyra,
for example, you know, has a long history of sinkhole occurrences there. Other places you can go look on Google Earth and find, and just by looking at using their little time traveler icon and go back in time, usually about 20 years, you can look at the landscape, how it looked 20 years ago, and find out, there's features there that you can see actual holes in the ground. So it's sort of, you know, one of the tools I use when an individual might call up and ask about, I have a sink on my property. Well, I'll take their information and tell them, I'll call them back. I'll go and investigate some of these older images and see if there's other possibilities other than, first find out if they're in a limestone area, and then see if there's other things that may show up on these images that can explain perhaps why they're having problems. The area was forested before they built their house, so that could be a possibility of, you know, there were tree roots in the ground that they didn't know about, or things like that, you know, or it was farmland and, the barn was right there where your house is, you know, those sorts of things, you know. So it just helps to narrow down the things that you can find out about their property. Because a lot of times homeowners don't really understand the history of their houses and their properties as to what was there before they built.
Yeah, we have short memories.
Yes, we do.
And history to us is 100 or 200 years ago.
Yes, exactly. And so those are, you know, and when they call up and say, I have a hole in the ground, well, okay, do you have, so you play 20 questions and it's basically you try to narrow down possibilities and in the end you can try to tell the and help them to determine what kind of repair method they can use to fix their particular problem.
All right, so I'm going to ask you a question. You said it depends, but is there more potential for future sinkholes if that limestone is underground?
Well, yes. I mean, you can, part of what we do at the Geologic Survey is to make maps. You know, it's part of our it's what we do. So one of my things I do, I plot out where the sinkholes occur. So you can see patterns looking from the air that'll give you, look at this limestone area here. You know, and you can actually see the features on the land surface there, and you can plot them out and say, okay, we're not saying you cannot build here, but we want you to take this into consideration when you're thinking about land use in these areas, and that you may have issues with, since it is a water-driven system, what are you going to do with your water?
Well, what do you see from the air that lets you know there's limestone underground?
Okay. As geologists, again, we usually have a map of the bedrock of the area. So we know where the limestone areas are throughout the state. But by using that aerial image, you're looking at it from the air, looking down on the land surface. And again, looking at it from a perspective of plumbing, clogged drains, that water just sits there in the bathtub because that drain's clogged. Well, it's the same sort of thing in nature. When the sinkhole is clogged with soil, the water will collect there and sit there until, and usually over a couple of days, it'll drain away and you won't know that it's there. But if you take the image at the proper time, you can actually see the locations of these drains and say, here they are, and plot them on a map and say, okay, these areas may have a higher chance of sinkhole occurrence than other areas. So you can almost make it a tool to say, all right, we know that, Yeah, these areas, we actually see sinkholes, and we see all these drains located here, these natural karstic drains over here. Perhaps we don't want to put a nuclear power plant over there. Maybe we want
to
make it passive recreational or something like that. That's low impact, you know, and let it lay nature kind of do its thing over there. So, you know, it kind of helps with, again, it's a land use tool to use so that you can anticipate issues that may occur down the road.
Let's anticipate a little bit more. So you and I assume you're talking about large areas of limestone. Is there a way for people to know, because I'm sure people listening to this today are thinking, I wonder if I have something in my backyard that potentially will open up in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way for people to know?
Again, this is a part of what we collect is this data, you know, and we try to make it available to the public. Well, we do make it available to the public.
By the way, we have a map of sinkholes from DCNR.
Yes.
A link on our website, WITF.org, that you can take a look at where some of the sinkholes are around the state. Sorry to interrupt you.
But that's exactly the point I was going to make, that, again, just finding out whether you're in a limestone area or not. You know, those are things you can find by viewing a geologic map. Now, that could be an alien concept to a lot of people, as you're not familiar with the lingo and, oh, what does this really mean? Geologists try to color code their maps so you can look at the colors and just match them up. And it makes it a lot easier to say, oh, well, the blue areas are the limestone areas and things like that, so that it doesn't, you don't need to be a geologist to interpret the maps and say that, okay, I am in a limestone area. All right, so that puts me in that category of, you know, the three doors, number one. Okay, I'm in a limestone area. Yeah, so limestone areas get sinkholes. So right away, that puts you in that category. What can I do as a property owner? Well, probably the most important thing is thinking about insurance.
Had a question here from Faith in Lancaster, asked just that exact question. Is there insurance for sinkholes?
And yes, there is insurance. But, you know, taking a look at the normal homeowner's policy, that little term sinkholes probably isn't on there. You know, and it's, from my understanding, it's more of a rider policy that you have to add to the homeowner's policy. So, you know, and this is how you get coverage for sinkhole. It's an additional thing. So when you go out and you read that policy and you look in the fine print and it doesn't say anything about subsidence or sinkholes, oh, well, then that's telling you that, yes, that your insurance probably won't cover that and that you may have to get that additional rider to, you know, at least cover the structure, your house. It may not fix the hole out in the backyard, but at least it will cover your house. And if you get damages, it'll cover that.
Okay, so let's talk about those repairs. Say there is an average-sized sinkhole, and I don't know what average is in Pennsylvania, but an average-sized sinkhole that opens in your backyard. How is it repaired?
When we think of sinkholes on an average, maybe, you know, maybe 3 feet to 10 feet in diameter at the best, you know, and maybe about the same in depth. You know, they typically, they're not the 60, 70, 80,
the
100.
The ones we see in Florida.
Yeah, yeah. No. It's generally doesn't work that way in PA. So you see this hole, and, well, typically what will happen, it's usually in the lawn or in the grassy areas. So all the grass that was at the surface is now down in the hole. And so you're looking down there, and it's like, well, you know, peeling back the rug, so to speak. You really don't know what caused the hole yet, but you see this hole. So you really need to pull back that rug and take a peek underneath and see what's down under there. There could be pipelines. There could be, again, buried structures, those sorts of things like that. That kind of give you clues as to, so there was a structure here at one point that, no, I see what it is, you know. But again, you're thinking, well, gee, should I go near that thing? Is it safe? Safety should always be the primary thing when something does occur. You don't want kids or dogs or your neighbors, you know, walking around. If it is a sink, it'd still be very unstable and could continue to collapse. So you want to be careful about it, you know, and safe, you know, put some flagging around it, some sort of barriers to keep the curious out of there. Like I said, you don't want people crawling around in it, because it's just not a safe situation right off.
Could you be? Can I interrupt you for a second? Could, as a homeowner, property owner, could you be liable if someone?
That I don't know, but I would. You know, it just makes some sense that it might. As a second thing, call up the local authorities, the municipal authorities. Call up the police if you feel that there's a safety issue involved. If there's a gas line in the area, well, geez, by all means, you call up the gas company and say, yeah, you know, we have a sinkhole here. You know, I know that the gas line runs out that way. You guys need to come out here, you know, because if it should get compromised in some fashion, it could turn, you know, a relatively safe situation into a more dangerous one for not just you, but your neighbors and such. So those safety, again, first off issue. So if you need some help, call the local authorities, because they'll generally have an emergency management plan in effect to handle such things like that. So, you know, and the fire department will know what to do to, you know, it theoretically should be in the planning for the municipalities as to what to do. But it has its drawbacks, too, in that it's on your property. You know, the most municipalities, their responsibilities like curb to curb. And so it's oftentimes difficult to get things done on your property. Again, there's a liability issues, and you can understand that too, you know, but at the same time, you have something here, you just want to get the thing fixed. You know, so there's other avenues to go, and usually it ends up with phone calls, and they usually end up at my office, you know, after calling up different agencies and things. And so it comes to our office, and again, we'll play the question and answer thing, but in the end, you know, we're not really consultants, so we can't tell you what to do, but just between you and me, you know, sometimes we can suggest things to do, you know. But so, but those are kind of how we do it. And then we could recommend, you know, it depends on your level of comfort too. If you feel that it's a real threat there, then yeah, by all means, you're going to call in the big guns. Get yourself a hired gun consultant to come in, evaluate your problem. Recommend a method of repair, and be there when the repair is being done so that there's guidance and making sure that it's done properly. And so, you know, and then if you go to resell down the road somewhere, when it's time to put in that disclosure clause, that disclosure statement that the realtors insist on, that, you know, you can say in there, yeah, we had a hole in the backyard. Here's the paperwork. Here's what we did, you know, and we haven't had a problem since. Sounds a little bit better than, well, I took a wheelbarrow of soil, dumped it in the hole, and, you know, and that's that. And then, you know, the next person buys the place and, you know, it opens up again.
A hole, like, and I keep going back to Tanger because
sure.
It was such, so different visually. You mentioned that the average sinkhole here in Pennsylvania may be 3 foot by 3 foot deep. That one, last I heard, 17 parking spaces. I don't know how deep, but it was deep enough that it didn't swallow. We used the word swallow, but cars sank down into the ground and deep enough that there was at least one woman who couldn't get out of her driver's side door wouldn't open. But at the same time, something that big, is that unusual? Is that one of the reasons we're talking about this today, is because a few of these sinkholes that have opened here in central PA over the past 2 weeks are larger than what we normally see?
Again, that was fairly a large one, but consider that typically what happens with sinks, sometimes you can have more than one in a given area, and a lot of times you get small sinks that will open up, and they usually will coalesce to make one large sinkhole. But it's also a matter of time. Usually in sinks, it may take a long time to set the stage for an event to occur. But when it does happen, it can happen fairly quick. You need some sort of trigger, and typically that's where the water comes in. You know, and that could be the trigger that caused things to finally, you know, the straw and the camel thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how you have to look at it, that a lot of the ones I see out in just in the fields, you can see, well, here's one, here's one, here's one. Come back several months later and find out that they've all connected to one another. And now instead of two or three 3 foot sinkholes, I have one 20 foot sinkhole. So it can be just a matter of time for these things to develop and create a large one. It just depends on the void that's down underneath.
What's the biggest one you've seen in Pennsylvania?
I've seen some that were maybe half a football field in length. So.
Wow.
And again, it's one of these situations where we had smaller holes, but over time, they've sort of connected up. And some of our larger ones may be up in the State College area, up along the base of the mountains, that, you know, simply because of their location and time, the water's running off the hills, and it's those sinks are just, you know, they've been there for a very, very long time. So you can see sinks there at 50, 60 feet, something like that. That's not uncommon in some areas along the ridges up in central part of PA.
What about deep? How deep?
Deep? I've seen some that were in that 60, 70-foot range, you know, and I've actually stood on the edge of some, looked down into it, boy, that's pretty deep, and go around the other side and see that I was standing on a very small lip of the sinkhole.
Yeah,
and
so say, you were taking your chances.
And I thought, boy, that was dumb, Bill. You know, so, yes, exactly.
You know, and as I mentioned, the last time you were on a year ago, we were talking about Palmyra. Palmyra is built on limestone. And it is only every few months before Sinkhole opens up. There's actually a restaurant and bar right there along Route 422 where a lot of them open called the Sinkhole. So, you know, I got to wondering, will that ever be solved? Because it as I said, it only seems to go every few months before there was a sinkhole right there along Route 422.
And again, they're in a unique situation, but you got to also consider when those areas were first settled. You know, we look at the limestone valleys that we have in Pennsylvania. They're nice. They're flat. Make good places to put roads because it is flat. Transportation was easy. Those are good places to build towns because we have good transportation. Water, the soil was great for agricultural purposes. So that's where these communities developed. And it always seemed to me that, well, I'm sure that when those initial settlers came in, they weren't thinking about sinkholes and where they may occur in the future and that sort of thing, or how the water...
Roads weren't paved, for one thing.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, you kind of think of that and how towns evolved over an area. And so sometimes those, again, those types of land uses sort of, you know, and understanding that relationship between the two, they get disconnected somewhere. And so, you know, when things do happen, oh my, you know, it's tough to go back in time to say, oh, you know, let's wipe the slate clean and rebuild this thing, doing it this way. Well, you know, in a lot of instances that doesn't work, you know. So we got to think of the problems that we do have and how can we help to move forward and remediate these things as they occur. So it's more like patchwork now as opposed to, you know, large-term projects, you know, and it's just, go ahead.
One final question, Bill. Climate change. We've heard a lot about climate change and its impact. You're holding up a whole notebook here. Climate change, the impact it may have here in Pennsylvania and around the world. One thing we've heard, more heavy rain events, more rain than we normally get. Does that mean that climate change could have an impact on these holes opening up?
Very much so. You know, you start thinking about the climate changes. A lot of times in sinkhole occurrences, you might go through a period of drought, and then, you know, you get the drought breakers, which are usually large storm events, and then you'll see lots of holes opening up after that, you know. So, again, it's just the cycles of that are natural, and as our planet goes through these climatic changes, and we do... You know, we may get more rainfall as a result. You know, it can work as a, you know, as those triggers to help create more sinkholes through time.
Our guest today has been Bill Kochanoff. He is with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation, Natural Resources, Senior Geologic Scientist. Bill, always fascinating. Thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you for having me today.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. At the end of last year, the Columbia Borough Council in Lancaster County unanimously voted to enact an ordinance that requires Columbia businesses, apartments, and nursing care facilities to have lock boxes, also known as Knox boxes, installed outside their buildings. The boxes are intended to contain keys and building blueprints to be used by emergency personnel responding to events like fires. As I said, this is the end of last year, but now, 7 months later, some business owners are pushing back against the ordinance, and we're going to talk to some guests today from Columbia government, the borough government, and also one of those business owners coming up a little bit later in the program. But first, John Novak is a Columbia Borough Councilman, and Douglas Kemmerly is the Columbia Fire Chief. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You.
Well, let's start with the reasons why. And by the way, this is not something that is unique to Columbia. There are a number of other places, municipalities in Lancaster County and throughout Pennsylvania that have lockboxes on the side of these type buildings. But Councilman Novak, let me start with you. Why lockboxes in Columbia?
I think one of the things that we had to take into consideration, Columbia is a relatively small borough. It's 2.4 square miles of land, and we have almost 10,400 residents that live in our borough. And that puts about 4,260 people per square mile within our borough. So safety had to be a primary factor in all of the decisions that we make. And safety of our residents, visitors, and businesses with the borough are and remain a top priority and focus of the borough council, its committees, staff, boards, organizations that operate under the Columbia umbrella, particularly our Columbia Borough Police Department and our Columbia Borough Fire Department. The conversation for the lockbox system started at the beginning of 2017 and became enacted by a unanimous vote by borough council in December of 2017. And the primary focus is and was and has to be the safety of our entire community. We certainly understand and appreciate private individual concerns, and we've made available for comment at our, since this has recently come to surface again, at our council meeting in July, and again just recently at a combined public safety and legislative meeting in August.
So I want to, public safety is the number one reason behind this. Chief Kemmerly, though, let me ask you, have there been occasions where your fire department has shown up to a building and you just did not know what you were going into, and you thought, well, if we had the blueprints here, we had a keyed way to get in, that we'd be able to get to this quicker or maybe even save this building?
Absolutely. One example we just had, was just last Saturday. We had an apartment complex that has, I believe, 12 apartments in it. When we pulled up, we got out of the fire truck. One of our first senses we used is smell. So we smelt something burning. At that time, we believed it was something on the stove. So we go to the second floor where we're met by four apartment doors. Each one of those doors were locked. Nobody answered the door. When we got to the second floor, we had no odor of something burning up there, but we had it outside. So we were still concerned because the fire alarm was going off. If there would have been a small fire in there and we did not investigate it, it could have potentially taken out half of the block on South 3rd Street and about four or five houses on Union Street, because we're, again, so densely packed that we have row home after row home after row home, and one fire that develops and grows can take out a whole quadrant of a block in Columbia.
I think a lot of people, unless someone has actually experienced this, they get most of their information from TV or movies, that kind of thing. What they picture is fire department showing up, take an axe, break the window, unlock the door. That's how you get in.
Sure, and we can do that. But again, the mission of the fire department is to preserve property. We're not here to destroy property. Though some people don't think that because of the damage we do, because we have to make sure the fire is out. Our job is to preserve life. Obviously, life is our first priority, and our second priority is property. And with an axe, with that same apartment owner, if we would have forced all four of her doors that owned that property, she's probably looking at a $2,000 to $4,000 expense to replace those four doors, because it's not just a door. It's the frame around it which ends up getting broke. It's the doorknob. It's the door lock. So, again, we're in the business to save property and not destroy it if we absolutely can avoid that.
Councilman Novak, from what you've described, this ordinance is in effect now. It's just that there have been warnings to those who haven't complied. But the part of the ordinance would, there would be a $600 fine or 30 days in jail if someone did not pay that. Am I accurate in saying that this is in effect now?
The ordinance is in effect. When the ordinance was put into effect in December of 2017, the ordinance states that there is a one-year window for compliance. Now, the borough used as a means of education and communication through our codes department, who does yearly fire inspections on specific properties, rentals, and commercial businesses within our borough. So during that process period, it was part of the fire inspection education that going forward and starting in January of 2019, that they are required. When we were doing that education with the fire inspections, we explained to them two things: the benefits of having them, costs overriding certainly safety, and certainly overriding possible replacement costs. And also, as part of the ordinance, it does list that it is a non-compliance that a notice of violation can be issued, and there is fees and charges that are associated with that. And yes, the ordinance also does list up until possible jail time.
Mm-hmm. So, final question for you, because I did want to talk with one of these business owners in just a few minutes. But the objections that you've gotten are privacy one, cost. There's another reason. I mean, these things could cost $200 to $700. Privacy, security, that some of these business owners are concerned that these lockboxes could be tampered with or destroyed, and there would be a key. There would be blueprints. So how do you answer those things?
Well, first of all, just the first objection that you brought up was the fact of cost. And yes, the Knox boxes cost, and they are a cost to either the business owner that owns the building or the business that's in the business. Mainly, I would feel that it would be the owner of the building's responsibility, which in many cases is the business owner. And they do run anywhere from $300 to $700 based upon the size that's required for the building. Many of the smaller businesses or smaller apartment complexes would only require probably a $300 box. Again, we're weighing out cost versus safety. And not only, and not to lessen anything, the property that they own or the people that may, if there are apartments attached or homes adjacent to, but also a primary look at was, we operate our borough with a all-volunteer fire department. And we need to look at the safety of those individuals. It has come to light most recently about the loss of life of volunteer firefighters and first responders that, you know, there is every day when they go out there, they're putting their life on the line to protect and serve the community of which I'm a part of. So the cost, there is a cost involved, and it's a cost that definitely doesn't outweigh the safety factor of their business and our fire department.
What about the part that, and if I could ask you to be brief on this one, because I do want to get to Kenas Super Cup in just a few minutes, but tampering with these that possibly a burglar could get in.
The Knox box system, now our ordinance says lock box. The fire chief has decided lock box is the company that we chose because of their high UL rating for security in business over 40 years. We've been using these in the borough for over 20 years on a voluntary basis. And now as the community continues to grow and businesses come in, we needed to look at what other ways can we protect our citizens and our fire company.
And you think that this would do it? Hey, gentlemen, I have to take leave of you right now. John Novak is a Columbia Borough Councilman. Douglas Kemmerly is the Columbia Fire Chief. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right, now I want to turn to Kenas Sukup, who is owner of Sukup Automotive in Columbia. She circulated a petition against this ordinance. Ms. Sukup, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you got to hear what Councilman Novak said and the Fire Chief Doug Kemmerly had to say. Do you still oppose this ordinance?
Absolutely, I do 100%. And so do all the businesses that signed the petition.
And why is that?
Well, so two of the issues that you had brought up were, security, as far as if the box can be tampered with, and then also the cost was brought up. But honestly, what we are most concerned about is neither of those. I mean, they're on the list, but the highest for us is accountability. If anything goes wrong with this box, whether it's a manufacturer defect, and somehow the box is used in a way that, gains access to our building, it says right on Knox Box's website, they are responsible for nothing. And so to me, the responsibility would fall on the borough at that point. They forced us to put them up. So if anything were to happen to our property because of the Knox Box being, whether it's faulty or whether, a member of the fire department or the police uses their key in a way that it's not supposed to be used, there's no accountability. Everything would fall back on us as the business owner. So to us, accountability is number one.
Again, you got to hear what Councilman Novak had to say and Doug Kemmerly, the fire chief, that the safety of the borough and its residents, so the first responders, that it outweighs cost. Now, as you just said, that's not the main concern that you have. But what about that safety factor? As I pointed out, there are other municipalities that have these lockboxes.
Right. And you know what? The other municipalities can do whatever they want, and those are not my concern. My concern is how my business is in Columbia Borough, and the other 42 businesses that signed that petition, that's what their concern is as well. We don't care what West Hemfield is doing. We don't care what Mount Joy is doing. We care what Columbia Borough is doing, and we care if the council is listening to us. I don't need laws and ordinances to protect me from myself. There is something called the cost of doing business. And that is if we choose to not have a lockbox and that means our door gets broken in, hey, you know what? That's the cost of doing business. We accept the fact that employees make mistakes and we pay for those mistakes. We accept that, at some point our business can be compromised and that is the cost of doing business. And we want the right to choose whether or not that box is on the front of the building, and we want the right to choose who has access to our building and how.
So you don't like the aspect of this that it's mandated. We only have about 30 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So what's next? What do you plan to
what's
do next?
Well, I'm going to, I'm going to get some other information put together. Just in January, there was a Knox box that was, the master key was used to gain access and steal tens of thousands of dollars worth of stuff from it. And so, I will continue to gather information and I will go to the next meeting and hopefully there's other business owners behind me that are willing to continue to fight for this to become voluntary and not mandated.
Where was that burglary that you're talking about?
Texas.
Oh, Austin, in Texas.
Texas.
Okay. All right. So Kenas Sukup, owner of Sukup Automotive in Columbia, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
We bring this to your attention because this is something that other municipalities may be considering. As we see, there are already some that do have them. Coming up on Monday, proxy wars. Yeah, it's something that's going on that we probably know about, but maybe we don't. That's coming up on Monday's show.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, bringing quality care to your community through Harrisburg, Community Osteopathic, West Shore, Carlisle, Hanover, Lancaster, Lititz, and Memorial Hospitals. More information is available at upmcpinnacle.com.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, when your city is under siege from flooding storm surges, what do you do? The Army Corps of Engineers wants to enclose New York City in floodgates. We'll talk about engineering the coasts from the Northeast to New Orleans. Plus, the Earth had its own natural nuclear reactor billions of years before we invented it. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
That's today from 2 to 4.
Hi, I'm Katie Meyer, Capital Bureau Chief for WITF. You're listening to WITF FM Harrisburg 89.5, Lancaster 99.9, and WYPM Chambersburg 93.3, and online at WITF.org, your home for NPR News and all things regional.
It's not nice to call anyone a dog, and this week of all weeks, all we're asking for is a little respect. Just a little bit. From WAMU and NPR in Washington, this is 1A. Hey there, I'm Todd Zwillick in for Joshua Johnson. Today on 1A, it's the Friday News Roundup. New evidence comes to light about the extent of sex abuse and efforts to cover it up by the Catholic Church. The president calls on his attorney general to sue drug makers for creating the opioid epidemic, and the media bands together to call out President Trump. Real votes are cast around the country to set up real races in November, and of course, the world remembers the Queen of Soul. We'd love to hear from you. Watch our live stream and comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A dozen former CIA leaders have signed a letter supporting ex-CIA Director John Brennan in his feud with President Trump. NPR's Greg Myrie says it's unusual for the intelligence chiefs to criticize the White House.
The 12 former CIA directors and deputy directors say they feel compelled to address what they call the unprecedented remarks and actions by the White House. President Trump on Wednesday accused Brennan of erratic behavior and revoked his security clearance. Brennan is a sharp critic of the president, and the former intelligence officials stress they don't all agree with his comments about Trump. But they defend Brennan's right to speak out, adding, "We have never before seen the approval or removal of security clearances used as a political tool." Signatories include former CIA directors Michael Hayden, Robert Gates, Leon Panetta, and David Petraeus. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has tweeted he's canceled a proposed